Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to another edition of Speaking of Reliability. This is Adam Barrett.
And this is Fred Schandelberg. You pulled out your deep voice, dude, there, Adam.
Oh, did I?
Yeah.
You know, because I got nervous.
Did you put your tie on or something? Or...
No. Well, if you notice, when I started, I had to restart. I was like, hey, this is, all right, I got to redo it. And then I guess I got serious about it. So yeah. I apologize, everybody. I didn't mean to do my after dark voice.
That's right. Well, Halloween is coming up in a couple of weeks here. So when we're recording this, I think this will come out a little afterwards. So, but we were just talking in our last episode about reliability testing a little bit, and we kind of touched on sample size. That is probably the most frequent question I get from program managers or from directors of engineering or from the supply chain folks going, how many protos, you know, how many, it's just all, it's perennial. And it's not just reliability. I think quality people face this too. How many samples, right? What do we need? How much money are you going to spend is kind of the underlying piece of it.
Well, I mean, I think you and I already, I think the only way to deal with this question is I think you and I should do some like therapeutic role playing here. Because it's such an annoying conversation to have, and I'm so tired of having it. So I think like, here's a question. Like, so somebody says to you, well, with the binomial, I saw, you know, with success testing that I can test 90, you know, for 90% reliability and a 90% confidence, it shows I can test 23 units. But for 99% reliability, I need to test 50 units to only get 36% confidence, you know,
right.
What does that mean? Does that mean I can tell me, Fred, I hired you as my reliability consultant. What does that mean? So what does that mean? If I order 23, I'm good. Or what should I do? I can't order 100.
Well,
if I order 50, I can't show 99% reliability is good.
That's right. It's a trade-off. It's a risk. And your option is, let's, one, not do the binomial test. Let's go figure out what's failing and why.
And then what should we do? So you're saying I should just do some random testing? It doesn't give me any confidence and just try to learn about what fails?
You know, reliability confidence, your statistical confidence is probably not what you think it is one idea. And if I know you know statistics, then it's not the end game. You don't need to know the confidence. You need to know what's going to fail and when. Right. So let's take those 22 samples that you have, not 50, but 22, and run them all to failure. Now we have a time to failure distribution, and we can say what's going to happen at 1%, what's going to happen at 10%, what's going to happen at 30%. The closer we get to the middle of that distribution, the more confidence, the tighter the bounds will be, the more precise that estimate is going to be. But out on the tails, where we're usually very interested, when's the first 1% going to fail? When's the first one going to fail? It's vague. We'd have to test thousands of units, you know, and we probably would still not know.
So I'm the project manager in this thing here. So I have to put somewhere in my schedule what it's going to take for us to get to 90% confidence, because that's what the business unit says they want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's design a specific test for the dominant failure mechanism or mechanisms, if there's more than one, and we can get. Usually we can use samples or coupons or subsets of our system, which is much less expensive and usually easier to get. And you can get pretty darn close to that. Couple that with modeling and the other information we have. Testing's not the only way to get to that result. And we could really narrow down. This is a generic answer because I don't know what product we're dealing with. But there's usually a way to focus in your evaluations so you get a more precise answer, but on a smaller scale of your product. Like, for example, if I'm testing a computer, like a laptop, and I know that my hard drive is the most risky piece in there, I'm just going to pick on hard drives. Although I should pick on power supplies, because they're usually a prime suspect. But if I can apply the stress to that subsystem, that hard drive, separately, I can do it much more efficiently, and I can monitor it much more closely than when I package it inside a larger unit. Now, the risk is that there's interactions there, interfaces and stuff that are really going to cause the problems. And I'm giving up. I'm saying engineering judgment says we've got that handled, that we know that this piece is the problem. It's one way to combat that. And there's probably a dozen other techniques to trade off time and resources and samples to get to an answer that's reasonable for you. And in some cases, you just can't get there from here, right?
Right.
I mean, that happens, but it's almost always a trade-off. I actually had a boss once say, well, why don't you use that, you know, 99% reliable with 36% confidence? What's wrong with that? We just take more risk. And he says, well, you have a better chance of flipping a coin right now and not doing the testing of picking the right answer. You're really not learning anything with that poorly of a design test. So right. Don't bother. It's not worth your time to do the test. And that's a constraint on testing, right? I could go test one unit, or I could walk past one unit, put my hand on it and go, yeah, I think that's going to be good. But you got to recognize that that's just a guess.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's the hard thing getting people to is understanding that we're doing this as intelligent people that understand our product and trying to learn more about how the product behaves. Mm-hmm. And it's not about some statistics number that we're going to put out there that gives us a go, no go.
Right.
Right. Because to do that, in truth, you need extremely high sample sizes, and they should be from varying populations you're manufacturing and varying use places and all this stuff. And a big research project, really, to really get confidences that mean anything, as opposed to these kind of shoot by the hip with a zillion assumptions in there, and really shifting people. I think that is your answer is to summarize your answer, tell me if I'm correct, is to tell people like, no, we're going on an engineering exploration here to understand what we've designed and figure out where we need to improve it. That's what's important.
That's right. Right. Yeah. And I think, and there is a criteria. I had disagreed with Dr. Hobbs, years and years ago. And he's not around anymore to argue with us anymore on it, but his approach was, well, go find what fails and go fix it. Improve it, change your designer process so that it's less likely for that failure to occur. Make your product as robust as you can, and don't worry about time to failure information, right? Just build, test, fix over and over again and make it as robust as you can. Yet we do get that question all the time of, well, how do I know it's going to last long enough? And it might be very specific, right? I want this goal and so on. But I think you're exactly right. It's when I see somebody write a reliability goal, I want to be 90% reliable with 95% confidence. And I think they really don't understand what they're asking for.
Yep. You know? Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, that's the thing is that they want a go, no go for their program. It's right. A program question.
It is right? Oftentimes a program question. Now back to sample size though, which even if we have full reins over how we interact with the team, they trust us, we know what we're going to do. The program manager is going to look at us and go, all right, how many samples are you going to need? It's for planning. We got to set up logistics, and some of the items are long lead time. And if we don't prepare for them well in advance, they're not in the budget. And they're not going to happen. And so all of a sudden we find out that we don't survive over 60 degrees C. If we don't have any more samples, end of exploration, end of study, end of understanding it. So it's a guess early on, but put something in the mark, put some thought into what do you expect the problems to be. The early FMEA type work will help a lot. Would set something out there. I don't know if you found this, Adam, is that sample size dance, even if they don't ask you for all the details and calculations and everything else, is you'll say, I need 22 samples, and they come back and say, you need 11. You're only going to get 11, and then it's the dance. I've almost always asked for twice as many as I want. Maybe my reputation precedes me, so they always give me half as many. So
well, actually, you know what? To be honest with you, I almost hope they give you half. This is why. If they give you half, you can explain how you're not going to get the confidence you want. Yeah. If they give you the 22 you ask for, you and I both know we're not going to get the confidence that we said because everything's not going to go perfectly.
Yeah.
And then they're like, hey, I gave you 22. How come you're not telling me it's a 90% confidence? You know what I mean? Like, so yeah. You almost, from your and my perspective, we're almost better off if they argue with us about sample size. So we can, because they aren't going to listen to the real answer, which is no, we shouldn't be pursuing this anyway with such a small numbers.
Yeah. So. Now, I think I've told you before is that I had all the tests I've ever set up and run, designed all the accelerated tests. I've only had one where I had as many samples as I wanted, and it was for zip ties. We were comparing three different vendors' zip ties for their tensile strength and aging them over time, obviously. And I had thousands and thousands of samples. It was great.
Yep.
Except that right. I only had one Instron machine and one Tech, so I was limited by how many I could actually measure.
Right. Yep. I mean, and it makes sense when you tell people too to put, you know, put the emotional confidence to it too. Mm-hmm. Would you really be confident getting in something that's had 20? Would you really say you're 90%, 99% confident in something that has had 20 things tested? You know what I mean? Like, no, of course you wouldn't if it was a life and death thing.
Well, Well, part of it is remember that the typical confidence you're talking about, the way I understand it anyway, is it does your sample that you're evaluating, if randomly selected from your entire population, which, by the way, we haven't made a fraction of that population yet, so it can't possibly sample from the entire population, represents the population, right? So when we say it's going to have 98% reliable at 5 years, that it's a reasonable expectation that the population will do the same thing. Now, what's not in that number, that confidence configuration, is are we even doing the right test? Do we understand what we're measuring? Where's the measurement error? That's not accounted for in that confidence, right? There's all of those other variables and uncertainties are still there. So it's not a surrogate for what risk, total risk you're taking. It's a recognition that the sample may not represent the actual population's performance. That's all.
Right.
Yeah. Now, but they still want a number. So I say, you know, 6,000 or some huge number. And then it starts that conversation. Well, what is it you need to know? And how well do you need to know it? And it's a trade-off. And it's in the initial discussions are to bracket your budget, right? Essentially, and timeline. And then as you learn, I probably say this safely is that I have never used my samples as first anticipated ever. We've learned things along the way and we shifted samples to where we needed to learn more.
Right. Exactly. That's the thing, is that the testing itself guides the testing where it's going to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other, you know, one of the things I find so many people miss when they're setting up a program is we're in competition with the software folks who need samples to run their trials on, the firmware folks, the user interface folks, all the other teams that need prototypes, right? And they have legitimate needs to have prototypes. We don't get them all. And as you know, we're in competition with all of these other reasons for these essentially valuable prototypes. And what I find many people forget is that just because it's on a software bench and it's running, it's accumulating time and it's being exposed to stresses and so on. But you could filter that to find out what's its time to failure. What were the errors they found? If the culture's there and the software guy said, oh, this bracket broke off, well, that should be recorded and, you know, sorted out and put into the fracas system to sort out. But if that is done well across the board, that can contribute to your reliability estimation at the end of the day. Those are all tests. Every time somebody tries to use your product, that's a test. That's an experiment. And those add up. Now, of course, this is with you accepted, Adam, because
Yes, the way I've used it is not one of the use cases they originally defined.
That's right. That's right. Just to
But I always yield valuable information. It's whether or not they asked for it, but they use it someday.
That's right. But it, I mean, I think the 20 samples we get for the reliability lab, and we have to divide it up in environmental tests, and we have to in some compliance tests and some regulatory tests and all these other things that oftentimes we get involved with. Every one of those, with a little bit of thought, can yield useful information. That might not get you all the way to the end of what you need, yet you can leverage those things so that you don't have to repeat that sets of stress before you come up with a final answer.
Yep.
And also, like your use of it, the use case 7 scenario is please get the entire team to pay attention to any anomaly. If it doesn't behave like it should, it's worth noting and investigating. And the hard part is that I ran into this. The software team complained that I had to reboot it twice before we could start the program on it. And so the quality guys grabbed it and took it away from them for 2 weeks. So they were without a prototype for 2 weeks. And that was the last time they reported any failures.
Yeah.
So you got to be careful about how you work with the other teams to get the information.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, that's the thing, though, is everybody coming together and prioritizing what are the objectives and then working together as a team, right?
That's right.
It might be more important to do the other guy's test first.
Yeah. And that's where those FMEAs and the risk management type things come into play. One of my favorite teams is there was like 8 of us all together that would meet weekly to go over, what were the priorities? What did we learn? What have we gathered from our prototypes and simulations and modeling and so on? And the program manager was really good about distinguishing, all right, we know enough now that issue is settled. We put it away, right? Move on. And then others, he said, we don't know enough yet. What do we need to do to get better information? It's too uncertain at this point to decide. And then there's another group of, that's an issue. How do we get the information we need to either do root cause or design change options or supplier questions or what's the next step to solve this one, to chip away at it? And then those got prioritized. All 3 of them got prioritized. And that's how he allocated resources and time for his team. And I thought it was brilliant because it's not just, is the test done yet? Right. It's what do we need to know? And do we know enough?
Yep. Right. Right. Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. It's really these fundamental mindsets that come from experience and listening to the people who have the experience.
Yeah, I learned that from those guys. So it added to my experience there. Hopefully this podcast adds to a few others along the way. But as soon as you start into that sample size conversation, it's a ball of twine, right? It's just, it can unravel. But if you focus it on, well, what do you need to know and how well do you need to know it for you to make a decision? And here's the trade-offs. And all of the other uncertainties that come into play with this, I think that can, to me anyway, helps trigger that setting up that mindset across the organization.
Yep.
But if the only thing they want is, do I need 22 samples or 77, I think, or 50 or whatever the magic numbers are from the binomial, well, you got a lot more work to do.
Right. Right. Exactly. Either if they're not going to listen to you, just give them some number, knowing that they're not going to demonstrate that confidence anyway. They're going to discover a lot of issues or see if you can explain it to them and have them understand.
Yeah. No, it's, I guess that's what makes it interesting. No, that doesn't make it interesting. That's tedious.
No, it doesn't.
I like breaking things.
It's frustrating. Yeah. It's frustrating having that conversation over and over and over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I should go back to that team that got it. And just work with them.
Like, there you go. Your favorite. They'll be your best. You have your best customer list and you just go
stay
work
with
them.
Yeah. No, it was boring though. They made the same product over and over again. So I was like,
yeah.
Can't deal with that.
Yeah. Sure.
Oh, it was a game controller, and they had all these buttons on it, and they had all these pneumatic compressor things, and they would punch away at these buttons, and they would push every single button on the game controller a million times. I'm like, why? Well, that's the rated value for these buttons, that we only buy buttons that are rated to be used a million times. Why? It takes you weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks to do one sample in this rig. Why? The on-off button gets used maybe twice a day.
Right. You know? Right. And why not test what happens when you drop the thing, use case 7, when that's really what's going to cause the issues, right?
Oh, yeah. No,
a button that's designed to go a million times. Did you mount it in a way where it stays in position when it gets dropped on a hardwood floor? That's the real question.
That's it. Exactly. Or you pour Coke or other liquids on it, or, you know.
Exactly.
It was one of the game controllers was like the tennis game where you're swinging and it had a little accelerometer in it and it could tell your swing and where it is and all that stuff. And the question is, well, what if a 6-foot person swings hard for a serve and they lose it from their hand? And he says, well, you would have loved that testing, right? We went and got a bunch of flat screens and found out how close do you have to be to break it?
Right.
It was easy to embed it in drywall. That was fun. That was easy.
Right.
And it would still work. He just dust it off and it would work. But shattering the
drywall
TV,
takes all the energy, right? It breaks. Yeah. It's like your crumple zone.
Yeah. But you'd bounce it off a screen and it was as good as off a hard. If you hit a stud on a wall, that also was a bad thing for the product. But that was fun testing to find out how to do it.
Yeah. That's my style right there.
There you go. How would you, here's a weird one that team came into is, because it was portable and a game controller type thing, it could fit in a back pocket that one of the designs we were making. And so one of the questions was, well, what if somebody sits on it?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we found that if it's on a soft couch type thing, it deflects way more than if it's on a hard surface, because the hard surface supports it. Right. And it doesn't deflect very much, but if it's soft, and your butt bone hits it in the center, it's a 3-point bend. It'll go quite a ways. And the risk is that if it breaks and gets sharp, a hard plastic sharp edge type thing, it could really cause some damage to your skin. So they beefed up the design. So you could basically just, I don't know what the foot pounds was, but it was an amazing amount of force to make this thing even crack.
Interesting.
Yeah, they just designed that one right out. It was pretty cool, but because of the liability, the consequence is you really cut somebody hard,
right?
And
right,
that would be bad. And there was no argument about the likelihood that it would be sat on. So it was like, okay, well, let's just fix that.
Oh, it's guaranteed.
Yeah. So they were pretty creative. This team had probably 30 or 40 different things that we went off and characterized. So how much force does it take? And is that enough to have enough margin for these things? And it was drop test in about as many different creative ways as you could come up with. Yeah. No, it was a fun project.
That is fun. It's great when people take the time to investigate those things, right? It's the time and convincing people the value of it, right? Because that is where the real benefit and advancements come from.
That's right. That's right. Yep. So anyway, they didn't ask about sample size all that often. That
was cool. Because they were interested. They knew it was valuable. Well, the other thing too is they had a product that was not dramatic. It was not incredibly expensive to get, you know, volumes of. So
no, that was all fun. So cool. You know, if you're listening to this and you're dreading your next conversation with sample size, hopefully we gave you a few tips or hints here to help you get through that a little bit easier. But also, I think mostly, Adam, we just said, yeah, good luck. It's it's a painful conversation, usually.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, let us know what works for you, what doesn't, how you get through these kinds of conversations. And at the end of the day, the samples are a means to an end. And how do you add value to that team you're working with? So success stories would be cool. We should ask for some of those occasionally. So head over to AscendoReliability.com/go/SOR, and you find a contact form there, and you can provide us a little bit of insight or information or a question or an idea for a future podcast. We'd love to hear from you. In the meantime, let's go break stuff.
Done. Absolutely.
I was expecting to hear the microphone hit the floor there and crash.
No, let's be clear. I don't break stuff I have to pay for.
Oh, okay.
I break other people's stuff.
So hire Adam to go break your stuff for you.
Exactly.
He takes joy out of doing that.
If the Blue Yeti microphone company wants me to break their microphone, I'm happy to.
But. Okay. Yeah, maybe we should get them to sponsor us. That'd be cool.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. So we could break their stuff.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, cool. Well, Adam, we'll let you go. Head off before we do end up doing a trial on stuff sitting on our desk. And then we'll go out and break other people's stuff.
I love it. All right. All right. Talk to you later.
Yeah. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.